Well, good morning. Welcome to each one. Thank you for reading that passage. That is very applicable to today's lesson, and I understand why they had it in there, and I'm thankful you read that. And first of all, I would like to thank Kevin for covering for me for a couple of weeks while we were gone. Appreciated that. Learned a few things from that as well. So we come to, maybe I should mention this too. You might notice in today's PowerPoint a little bit of what might appear to be a hodgepodge of some other PowerPoints put together. And so some of this was from lessons that I had when I taught school, PowerPoints, some things taken out, some things left in, some things just kind of put together. So if you notice that, and also I realized that I did a lot slower transitions back then on some of the things coming in, so you'll notice that as well. One of the things we come to in today's lesson is the idea of, and we're going to see that toward the end of the lesson, and hopefully you've been reading your books, and you'll see that they put a lot in here about what happened in Pennsylvania, New York, and it happened down into Virginia, different places, when actually there were wars that broke out. And a lot of it came back to how they were going to deal with this whole thing of non-resistance. And if there has been one doctrine that has been front and foremost to the Anabaptists throughout history, with the exception of some of those we looked at, some of those radical movements, has been the idea of non-resistance. Even now, what I would say the more liberal wing of the Anabaptist church today would call it pacifism, and there is a difference. We don't have time to go into that, but that whole idea of being a peace church, peace people, and not fighting something. The early Anabaptists especially would have rather have been killed than to kill someone else. That's just their understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and rightfully so. And so that has affected a lot of things. It was mentioned, I think Kevin mentioned it, like some of those groups that left and went here and there, non-resistance was a big deal. When they came to America, non-resistance was still an issue, so much so that you'll notice later in today's lesson that it actually divided some people in Pennsylvania, Christian Funk and others, over do we pay the tax that gets us out of being in the military, do we not pay it, and so forth. And so it's caused a lot of tensions. How far do you go in obeying the government, et cetera, et cetera? And we faced a little bit of that just a few years ago ourselves in this country. And unfortunately, it did divide some churches. That's just the way it was. And so this whole idea of non-resistance, where do you draw those lines, and so forth, is a big deal. So much so that, just to give you a little bit of an example, this church here, the first pastor here was Ruard Schmid. And if we get a chance at the end of this whole thing, we'll maybe talk a little bit about our history. But Ruard Schmid had come here from Holland. He was a Hollander, basically. He came to this area just a couple miles down the road in the middle 1800s. And part of that was so that their children didn't have to be scripted into the military and so forth. A number of years later, when the Indiana Michigan Conference was looking for a place for missions outreaches, they were down in, I think, Brown County, Bean Blossom area somewhere, and they ran into this old hermit up in the woods. I understand, kind of living off by himself, this hermit guy. It was Ruard Schmid's son, who was first pastor of this church, and his main question to them was, do the Mennonites still practice non-resistance? That was his question. It was a big enough deal. He understood one of the reasons why they came here to this country and so forth. Did they still practice it? And so it plays a big part in our history and some of these trials that we went through. In Europe, before we get into this lesson, just so you know, and one of the things that brought them here, in Europe, the persecutions changed in some areas over a period of time. But there was still persecution. Even in areas where they were not physically persecuted, a lot of the farmers had to farm maybe above a certain altitude. Well, you can farm, but you're going to do it up in the mountains. Or you can do this, but you have to pay a heavier tax to do this. Or you have to. And so These were things that were a strain on them, even though they weren't always physically persecuted and killed. But by the time the Amish, at least, start coming to America, one of the things we have to remember is it had been approximately 200 years since the beginnings of the Anabaptist movement. And that's one of the things I liked about what the passage that Jerry read this morning in our books. It's the fact that how do we pass along what we have? How do we pass that on to next generation for 200 years? And still keep the same zeal, still keep the same energy, the same vision. The early Anabaptists were very much evangelistic, going out and sharing the gospel, even if it meant their head. That's what they were going to do. By the time they came to America, after a couple hundred years of persecution, being chased here and there, losing their goods here and there, and so forth, and the voyage that we're going to look at that took to get here, a lot of them were just quite happy just to be someplace where they could live their lives, fellowship with their brothers and sisters in the Lord that believed like they did, and actually fellowship with some who maybe didn't to get started. And some of that zeal was gone. And that's unfortunate, but that's just what happened. So as they come to America, who were some of the first ones? Now, we talk in the book here, it talks about those in Germantown, and we'll get to them. But and again, I was a little concerned about some of these slides. They weren't designed for up here when I made some of these for school. But there were Dutch traders in New Amsterdam, or what's now New York, as early as 1644. So that's pretty early on. They weren't necessarily here for religious freedom. They were just here as traders. I don't know what they were trading, but they were here. And then there's this guy in 1663, Peter Plockhoy. He established a colony in Delaware. And it was the first significant Mennonite settlement in America, was located in Germantown. Let's talk a little bit about Plockhoy here. Plockhoy had lived with an experimental communal group in England. That was kind of something that he had done. He had observed the Anabaptist Hutterites in Moravia, and he became interested in land owned by Amsterdam in Delaware. And so in April 1662, the Amsterdam City Council agreed to help 25 Mennonite or Mennonist families go to Delaware. I believe there were others in this group as well. They were not the only ones. So he established his colony there in Delaware, along the Delaware River. And the colony was established in 1663, and he wanted to have a utopia. What Plockhoy's idea was, we're all going to share in common, where it's a utopia, everybody's going to be perfect, and everything's just going to be great. The problem is people came, including him. And his utopia wasn't maybe quite as great as he might have thought. He did. They wanted to have shared goods, meet military obligations with a tax rather than by personal service. Wanted to have religious freedom. However, and no slavery, slave trade, those were good. But he also wanted to exclude certain groups. They didn't want to have Catholics there. Didn't want to have any Jews, and he didn't want any stiff-necked Quakers. That's what he said. So his little utopia was, I don't know, maybe you have a utopia if you don't have any Catholics, Jews, or stiff-necked Quakers. I don't know what his idea was. But that was his idea. In 1644, the English and Dutch were at war over the colonies. English troops captured Holland's North American settlements and land, and they plundered Plockhoy's settlement, and it was destroyed. Now, I'm going to show a couple of things here, because if you study this kind of history at all, you may actually read what's coming up here. But then I'm going to give you some what has been more recent information regarding Plockhoy. Seems to be no trace of what happened. Plockhoy and his wife eventually showed up at Germantown 30 years later. By this time, he was old and blind. They lived out their lives there. However, new evidence would show that probably a few families that came were Mennonites. This guy here was a retired Washington lawyer, found some valuable information on that colony. A lot of it comes from that census. And the idea that it was wiped out is not necessarily so. There was a colony in the area at that time of the census, and some of the people that were part of Plaquoi's colony are named in that census, so they weren't all wiped out and killed. Some of them were his family, and I'm going to bounce through these fairly quickly. You can read them up there. His brother was actually listed in that census, and he was in Manhattan. At that time, it would appear that Peter Plaquoi actually died, possibly in that attack, and his wife then married someone else, and it was his son who showed up in Germantown 30 years later. So Plaquoi's son made it to Germantown and became a part of the Mennonites there. Probably was not the original one. Okay, that brings us to William Penn in Pennsylvania, which changed the world in a lot of ways. Even today, we would see the remnants of that. King Charles II owed William Penn's father £16,000, and I think I had figured this out. I wrote that down somewhere. I don't know if I put it in here or not, but I think it was doing the conversion. I think that was be around over $3 million today. It was a little sizable chunk of change. King Charles I, the Parliament eventually took his head off, and so there was a lot of turmoil going on in that country at that time, and he comes to power. William Penn had actually been part of a group of somewhat radical Whigs in that area, more commoner people. In the meantime, he had become a Quaker, Sir William Penn, his father, was a politician and admiral, and when King Charles was trying to stay in power, regain power, and so forth, he loaned him a bunch of money to help him do that. Well, I guess I did put it in here. It was likely over $3 million in today's money. So to settle the debt, after Sir William died, to settle this debt with his son, he gave him 45,000 square miles in America to settle the debt. Now, I didn't figure this out, but I wonder if you took all the property in Pennsylvania and figured out what that was worth, that wasn't a bad return for that $3 million that was owed him. If he could have lived long enough now to sell it all at today's prices, obviously he couldn't with the improvements, but it hasn't went down in value, let's put it that way. And so that's how he received that area. It's called Penn's Woods or Pennsylvania. William just wanted to call it Sylvania Woods, and King Charles II said, no, I want it to be called Penn's Woods in honor of your father, not necessarily him. And the Duke of York, and that's another whole story, but he was a Catholic, and there were struggles about him being in any kind of power or something. I think he wanted to appease some people, and he actually sold the lower three counties or whatever it was to Penn as well, which was Delaware. Penn had become a Quaker, and the other colonies were not very tolerant of all denominations. And I think that's one of the things, that's why I said Pennsylvania changed how we see the world when it comes to religious freedom. I think a lot of people think, well, from the very beginning of America, everybody just was like, religious freedom, however you want to worship, blah, blah, blah. No, there were areas that restricted, didn't want any Catholics. There were areas that didn't want whatever. The Puritans were not so open-minded to who all would be there. Massachusetts, for instance, had banned Quakers, and actually in Massachusetts, and I forget what year it was in the 1600s, actually executed a lady because she was a Quaker. And so not maybe the toleration you might think of when you think of America. But William Penn thought something better could be. The Puritans considered a lot of people a threat, frankly. Penn wanted freedom of religion along with people who would live lives of good character. The Mennonites and Amish found Pennsylvania a welcoming place and a relief from the years of persecution, and that's really what brought them there. And I think it says in our book, if you studied your book, that at one time, one year, the Mennonites actually had the highest number as far as a denomination or whatever. There were more Mennonites in Pennsylvania than anyone else. Later, a lot of Amish came to Pennsylvania, but this would have been a case at one time. Penn tried to deal fairly with the Native Americans living in the region. That was one thing that he felt was very important, to buy the land off of them, to work out negotiations. And that actually caused some problems with New York, because the governor of New York had worked out a situation where he was working with the one tribe of Indians who, and that tribe thought that they had kind of united all the Indians and anybody that they were all under one, which they weren't. Some of these in Pennsylvania did not consider themselves a part of this group. But so here you're dealing directly with these Indians, and they're supposed to go through this tribe so they can go through New York. And it was kind of a mess. It caused some problems, actually. But Penn wanted to deal with them. He did not want slavery in his colony. And along with a number of other good things that he wanted to bring to it. This takes us then to Germantown and the actual first continued, if you will, Mennonite settlement that really lasted a period of time and is actually still there. There's still a church there, and we'll actually see that church. And so Germantown is where the first Mennonites actually settled. We're going to spend a little time looking at that, but I want to read something first. A couple of things. First of all, just so we know later, that fixing the exact date that the first Amish arrived in the Americas is not really possible. Such names as Brandt, Bricker, Hirschberger, Hostetter, Huber, King, Kurtz, Lichty, Shirk, we've got some Shirks here, Zimmermans, got them, Zugs, which was Zooks, I believe, were found in Lancaster County as early as the 1920s. A lot of Amish tradition goes back to Widow Barbara Yoder and her descendants that came. Some question about the actual dates when that happened. I want to read to you a little something, though, because I think sometimes we maybe lose track of what it took for our forefathers to get here. And some of them would have preferred to just stay where they were at. There's a poem written by an Amish man that left Switzerland, and it's kind of sad when you read it. He talks about his home. He talks about visiting his parents' graves for the last time, seeing his homestead for the last time, the farms that he, the fields that he plowed for the last time, and on and on and on of just walking away and knowing you'll never, ever, ever see any of it again. And so it was hard for them to leave. But many of them, I think, felt necessary to do so for their children. It was getting harder and harder to live with some of the restrictions they had. And so Penn had invited them to come to Pennsylvania, and they saw an opportunity to actually go and live somewhere in peace. But it was not an easy journey. This comes from some writings of Dwayne Kaufman talking about an Amish voyage. This is here is written by just a German craftsman, Gottlieb Mittelberger. And he just says this, and I'm going to read some things here. Children from 1 to 7 rarely survive the voyage. And many a time, parents are compelled to see their children miserably suffer and die from hunger, thirst, sickness, and then to see them cast into the water. I witnessed such misery in no less than 32 children in our ship, all of whom were thrown into the sea. The parents grieve the more since their children find no resting place in the earth but are devoured by the monsters of the sea. It is a notable fact that children who have not yet had measles or smallpox generally get them on board the ship, and most of them die. Often a father is separated by death from his wife and children, or mothers from their little children, or even both parents from their children, and sometimes whole families die in quick succession, so that often many dead persons lie in the berths beside the living ones, especially when contagious diseases have broken out on a ship. Mittelberg also commented on the tragic lot of the large number of redemptioners who sold their labor as indentured servants to pay their passage. In most cases, the person had agreed to an arrangement voluntarily as the only means for getting to America. On other occasions, individuals were kidnapped by unscrupulous captains and sold to the highest bidder in the American port. One such case was Ludwig Lewis Reel, the ancestor of all Amish and Mennonite Reels. According to oral tradition, around 1750, now think about this if this was your son, at age 8, he was abducted, taken to America. And I believe he was just captured there in the city, so you'd never know what happened to your 8-year-old son. Abducted, taken to America, and bound as an indentured servant to a cruel master until he reached age 21. After suffering physical abuse and the indignity of sleeping with the hogs, he escaped and found a home with the Chester County Amish. An indenture dated 1767 bearing the name John Melchior Blankenberg has been handed down in the Plank family. According to tradition, he was the same Melchior Plank who died in Mifflin County. Here's his story. While living in Rotterdam, they boarded a ship to bid farewell to friends who were leaving for America. The ship captain assured them that the anchor would not be lifted till morning, so they spent the night with their friends. However, the ship left during the night, and the Planks awoke to the shocking reality that they had been kidnapped. Upon their arrival in Philadelphia, they were sold as indentured servants to pay their passage. It wasn't easy coming here. I'm going to read this, and forgive me if I show some emotion in it. It's just hard for me to read this. It's a diary by an Amish person that came here. And yeah, it's kind of hard for me to read it. This was the Charming Nancy, which was the first, I think, ship that came with a lot of the Amish in, I think, in 1727. This is what he wrote down. The 28th of June, while in Rotterdam getting ready to start, my Zermbly died and was buried in Rotterdam. The 29th, we got under sail and enjoyed 1.5 days of favorable wind. The 7th of July, early in the morning, Hans Zimmerli's son-in-law died. We landed in England the 8th of July, remaining 9 days in port, during which 5 children died. Went under sail the 17th of July. The 21st of July, my own Lisbethy died, several days before Michael Gorgley's had died. On the 29th of July, 3 children died. On the 1st of August, my Hansley died. And the Tuesday previous, 5 children died. On the 3rd of August, contrary winds beset the vessel. And from the 1st to the 7th of the month, 3 more children died. On the 8th of August, Shambeen's Lizzie died. And on the 9th, Hans Zimmerman's Jacobly died. On the 19th, Christian Bergley's child died. Passed a ship on the 21st. A favorable wind sprang up. On the 28th, Han Gosley's wife died. Passed a ship on the 13th of September. Landed in Philadelphia on the 18th. And my wife and I left the ship. That was it. A child was born to us on the 20th. Died. Wife recovered. A voyage of 83 days. Would we do that? So that's what it took to come to America for freedom of religion and to pass along what you hoped could be a non-resistant stance, not to see your sons put in the military, not to see them persecuted, et cetera, et cetera. And that was not uncommon. That was the common journey to America. And part of the problem was is those guys who run those ships packed the ships way too full. They didn't tell the people how many people would probably die on the way over. They weren't honest. They just wanted to get payment for bringing them here. So in Germantown was the first permanent Mennonite settlement in North America. 13 families totaling around 33 persons arrived October 6, 1683. On October 24, 1683, the town was laid out. Lots were drawn to determine who would receive which plots. So they just pulled lots to see where you were going to live. And a pietist by the name of Francis Pastorius was an agent in Frankfurt Land Company. He purchased 15,000 acres. He visited the Quakers and likely some Mennonites and encouraged them to come. The town was located approximately 6 miles north of Philadelphia, and that helps us understand a little bit maybe some of the tensions later with regard to the Revolutionary War. Philadelphia then was 1 year old, and it was about 8 miles from Constitution Hall. This was at Pastorius's home. So in Germantown, the first Mennonites to settle there were from Krefeld, Germany. They arrived on the Concord, and a group was made up of Quakers and Mennonites, and they worshiped together for some time. This is a picture of the, that's an old picture there, it's a newer picture. I'll show you a few other pictures of it. Only about 40 of them families settled there. 1708, they built a log meeting house and then later replaced it with a stone one. And most of the Mennonites that came in here, this settlement never really grew to be huge, and it still hasn't. And part of that problem was a lot of Mennonites would come into that area, but they would move on into, they would move west into Pennsylvania for farming and so forth. They didn't want to be in a city there, and so they would move on. So a lot of people did go through Germantown as their church. Here's some other pictures of it. Here's a picture I took of the interior of it, looking forward. I don't know how much of that is original, but you kind of get the idea of what it was like there. And so that's the church, or yeah, that's the church. It's still there, Germantown. You can visit it. This table, you wonder why I have a picture of a table here. From this group in 1688 came the first official protest to slavery in North America. And that document was signed by some Quakers and some Mennonites. And so again, maybe you say, well, you know, what have our Anabaptist forefathers ever done, whatever. The first written protest regarding slavery in North America was written by Mennonites and Quakers. That doesn't mean we have to be proud or anything like that. I'm just saying they, early on, saw slavery was not a good thing, and they weren't afraid to say so. And they still have that table that the paper was signed on, and that's still there. William Rittenhouse was the first Mennonite bishop in America. He had the first paper mill. And I'll just let you read that. I'll read it with you. This is a marker there. William Rittenhouse, first Mennonite minister in America, erected here in 1690 the colony's first paper mill. Successive generations of Rittenhouse built additional mills, establishing this area as a center of American papermaking. By the 1850s, this village had over 40 buildings, and seven early buildings survived from that time. And then it mentions David Rittenhouse there, so I'm going to tell you just a little bit about him. This right here, this was the original house, I believe. This was added on, I think, by William Rittenhouse's son, this section here, if I remember correctly. And this is a little summer kitchen, a little summer house that they would spend a lot of their time in, especially like a kitchen kind of area. This shows you a waterway that was made that they used for the water wheel to actually make the paper. I think there was a linen mill close to there, and he had actually learned how to make paper in Germany. I'm not sure if it was from family or who, but he had learned, he had been an apprentice there making paper in Germany, and so that was his business. They certainly had some wealth, at least especially after a period of time. And so you can, as far as I know, you can still go there and see the place. Just a little aside here, a quick little note on the family. And that is David Rittenhouse. This may not matter. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with us, other than the fact that perhaps even in William Rittenhouse's own family, some of the Anabaptist beliefs did not get passed down. So William Rittenhouse, I believe it was a great-grandson. Some say grandson. I think it was a great-grandson. It was David. Let's just go back to that. I'll tell you a little bit about him. You might have heard of some people that he knew very well. And I don't think I'm going to read everything about him. He helped survey the Mason-Dixon line in Pennsylvania, the southern line there. But more importantly, he was a clockmaker, a scientist, a philosopher, and you can actually go to Philadelphia today and go to Rittenhouse Square, which is named after him. A couple of things that he did was help with some of the early things regarding during the Revolution, some of those kinds of things, but He invented the oray, I believe it's called. It's a thing that a lot of colleges, I think, still have some of them where it actually shows the movement of all the planets and so forth. I think he actually discovered maybe the planet Uranus's path and so forth. He predicted an eclipse way back when he was young and kind of got some fame from that. But he was the second president of the American Philosophical Society, which still exists. It's the oldest organization like that, I think, in America. And the first president of it, and the guy that started it, was Benjamin Franklin. And then it was handed off to his friend, David Rittenhouse. He was also the first director of the U.S. Mint. There's a mint in Philadelphia, and with his love for just gears and cranks and clocks and all kinds of stuff, from what I understand, he made the first crank to make the first coin and handed it to his friend George Washington, and was also contemporary and worked some with Jefferson and some of those. So just a little aside, has really nothing to do with necessarily us, other than the fact that I don't think, if you read a lot about him and what all he was involved in, I don't think he was probably a non-resistant Anabaptist at that point. But Amish immigration to America, the dates vary. It's actually almost impossible to put a date on it somewhere in these ranges. The 1930s brought a significant number of Amish groups, and there was still tension between the Mennonites and the Amish at this time. So much so that these non-resistant, peace-loving groups would often not travel on the same ship. If they found out that there were Amish on the ship, the Mennonites might avoid that particular passage. If the Amish found out the Mennonites, and I think it was more often that, would find out that the Mennonites were on the boat, we'll take a different one. Thank you very much. We'll just wait in Rotterdam or wherever for an extra month. And so those tensions were still there. However, once in the Americas, and once they were in like eastern Pennsylvania, Berks County, the Amish were, especially in Berks County, some of those areas, some of those tensions tended to go away a little bit. And the fact that some of them found themselves in areas and there weren't a lot of other people around, and so you began to learn to get along with your neighbors, which was maybe different than what it had been back in Europe. And so those tensions did tend to change over time in the Americas. So when we think about this thing of non-resistance, just to kind of help us understand a little bit of this whole idea of non-resistance and the importance of it to the people, and I hope I brought that paper along. I did. I'm going to read this to you. The first published in 1660 in Dutch by, and I probably am not going to get his name right, but Thielman J. von Braught. It included more than 50 finely detailed etchings of noted Dutch artist Jan Luyken, and was used to strengthen the faith of the Anabaptist believers. That's the martyr's mirror. But in 1745, from this Germantown area and these early Anabaptists, 1745, Jacob Gottschalk arranged with the Erfurt Cloister to have them translate the book from its original Dutch into German and print it. It took 15 men 3 years to finish, and in 1749, at 1,512 pages, it was the largest single volume printed in America before the Revolutionary War. It was a big book for that time. They have some writings, even writing back to Holland and to these other people about this book. And it was they wanted to strengthen the church. And here's actually a quote from their writings. And think about this. This is 1745. We're pushing up toward the Revolutionary War. And apparently they saw it coming. This is what they say. As the flames of war appear to mount higher, no man can tell whether the cross and persecution of the defenseless Christians will not soon come. And it is therefore of importance to prepare ourselves for such circumstances with patience and resignation, and to use all available means that can encourage steadfastness and strengthen faith. Our whole community has manifested a unanimous desire for a German translation of the Bloody Theater of Thielemann, Jans von Brandt, Martyr's Mirror, especially since in this community there is a very great number of newcomers, for which we consider it to be the greatest importance that they should become aware with the trustworthy witness who have walked in the way of truth and sacrificed their lives for it. They were concerned of what was coming. And so they had that commissioned. So I talked a little bit about this already, non-resistance being a major belief of the Anabaptist, and the Revolutionary War brought many trials and persecution. And this was a problem up until World War II. And so the idea of, so there's several problems that really the Anabaptist faith faced. And the book brings a lot of this out. Many of them had even unknowingly sworn allegiance to the king, and so, or to those back home. And so they saw this revolution and these rebels as something they didn't know that they could support. And so because they didn't feel like they could support it and they couldn't fight in a military, et cetera, they were viewed as sympathizers to the other side. And so they were terribly mistreated. A lot of times their farms, lands, and whatever was confiscated. When some of the war moved from New York down into Pennsylvania, their farms were ravished. And this was not just during the Revolutionary War. During it, if you think about the Civil War, especially the Mennonites in Virginia suffered greatly. And all the way up into World War I, it was not easy to be a non-resistant Christian. There's a story that goes like this, even in World War I, and put yourself in this position if you were a young man. You believed in non-resistance. You had five men that were taken to a military camp to be put into the army, and they said, we won't do it. We won't put on the uniform. We won't do it. And so finally they took them out, and they told them all they had to dig their own graves. And this is World War I America, okay? So they dug, each one dug a grave, and then they went into a building, and they gave them another chance to recant, and they wouldn't do it. Now, if you had just dug your own grave, it'd get pretty tempting, but they wouldn't do it. So they took the first one out, and the others heard a shot. And eventually they took him out and showed him the covered grave, and you want to recant? Nope. And they did that to the last one. What they hadn't told him was they hadn't shot any of them. They were all still there. But they wanted to know, will you actually, is this something you believe enough that you'll stand for it even when you think two of your friends or three or four of your friends have already been shot and buried in the graves that you guys just dug? By the time of World War II, and we're getting way off from our years here, some of those things had changed. And some of you here, we're in 1W service, there was CPS, there were other opportunities. But I do want to go back and think just a little bit about Pennsylvania and the influx of Mennonites and Amish and the Quakers and those who did not believe in going to war and killing and believed in religious freedom. What is often called Penn's experiment shaped what we today think about as far as religious freedom in countries that actually have that. That was not something that was the idea of many of the first colonists in America. They still went back to their ideas of Europe, where if you're in this area, you're this, and you're in this area, you're that, you're here, you're this. So much so that there was a visitor to Pennsylvania, I think, that was so confused, he didn't understand how anything could function with all these people of different religions. But it worked. And so that has affected the world all around. Not that they didn't have to go through a lot of trials during some of those wars and so forth, but it did shape much of the world. thinking about that and thinking about some of the things that they went through there in the beginnings, it's interesting because as we start moving now through the book, we're going to see awakening movements, we're going to see some of this pietism and so forth, and we're going to see a lot of divisions in the Mennonite church in America from over the last several hundred years, a couple hundred years. And so it's interesting that that was kind of the foundational thing, and yet it was maybe hard to work some of those things out in actual life, and still is. It's just it's part of our history, and it's not just the Mennonite history. It's many other denominations as well. I will say this, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, Protestants tend to divide over doctrine, and Anabaptists tend to divide over application. Not always, but it has been kind of a front and foremost. What are your questions? What are your thoughts? What are something that you learned from this lesson at the coming to America? Or maybe one of the questions that's in the book here you'd like to talk about. I thought there was interesting. I hope you read the selected writing back here, Christian Burkholder, on the oncoming youth concerning true repentance. That was something I hopefully you read. But. Okay, someone have something you want to ask or something you want to share? Maybe one of the questions you want to focus on back here? Realize I didn't give you a lot of time this morning.
So, you know, when something happens like that, you know, we can only see today, back a few days and ahead a few days, but there's sometimes we're part of something bigger than we know about.
Well, and Sir William Penn, which was William Penn's father, actually would have never seen any of that because it was after he died that William Jr. wanted to settle up. And there wasn't money to do it. It actually wasn't so much of doing business. It was the fact that I think during some of those wars and so forth, Sir William was an admiral in the military and was wealthy. And so he helped. I don't know if he gave him ships. I don't know if he gave him money, whatever. It was like a loan. But yeah, you do have to wonder, okay, now where's the money coming from? And it didn't get it. And we're not actually sure if maybe William Penn went to him and said, hey, pay thou what thou owest, which was maybe a little risky, or what can we work out, or maybe he knew he had to pay it, and he just offered him this chunk of land over here. But yeah, you're right. Sometimes we don't know why things work out like they do, but think about how much different the world, and you can't go there really, but think of how much different the world might be, and the United States as well, had Sir William Penn never helped out King Charles II and ended up having $3 million that wasn't getting paid. So yeah, you're right. Sometimes we don't know why things happen, but it certainly shaped North America and the states and so forth. Somebody else. Do you think you could get people on an airplane to travel somewhere if the death rate was as high as it was coming across the water from Europe? I wouldn't travel at all. I'd stay put. But then on the other hand, my family, I'm not in a situation where my family's been persecuted for a couple of hundred years, and I'm looking for a better way. Okay. Somebody else has something you want to share? That's fine. If not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that happened. They came here, they relaxed, and I think, yeah, probably a couple of reasons. One, I think they were just finally ready to find a place they could just live in peace and be done with it, but that's not really what we're called to do. We're called to spread the gospel. And the other thing that we have to remember is, if you think about it in this way as well, by the time, now the Mennonites a little less time than this, but by the time a lot of them came to Pennsylvania, especially the Amish and even some of the, a lot of the Mennonites, it had been 200 years since the beginnings. Well, go back to the 1820s, and some movement had started in the 1820s. Think of what all's happened in the world since the 1820s. A lot has happened. World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Civil War, you could just go on and on and on. A lot of things have happened. A lot of things have changed culture. A lot of things have changed us. And so, yeah, 200 years, and they were tired of it, and they relaxed, and it wasn't a good thing. They lost their fervor. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your attention and input, and we will start looking at some things that happen in America in the next lessons. So you are dismissed.